nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here?
Nothing to see, nothing to see, nothing to see.
Experimental radio produced by NASCAD University.
You are listening to Nothing to See Here, experimental radio from NASCAD University. This episode is called Beecham's Pill, Notes on Entanglement.
Hello, everyone. Apple. Orange. Apple. Orange. Apple. Orange.
How to say one thing.
Apple.
While meaning something
orange.
Else.
Words. Apple. Orange. Apple. Orange. Apple. Orange.
Beecham's pills make all the difference. This was the advertising slogan for a popular laxative made in England in the late 19th century. But how does it make all the difference? What is the difference? How do you compare things? What does it take to compare one thing to another thing?
Situation. Choose.
We have to make choices, of course. But how do we assess the value of one thing compared to another?
Please sit down. Okay. Who's he?
He's my brother.
Is he sick? No. He's a vampire.
Everything light, sound, air, is all really translated into waves.
We have to make choices, of course. This is often a practical task of assigning a value to things. A basic unit is created so that an assessment can be quantified. So that measurement can take place.
To be or not to be, that is the question.
Money is a system like this. But not everything can be bought and sold. Sometimes things just don't fit. Sometimes the basis of comparison can't be established, and there cannot be an objective process for comparing things.
Substitution 2. Choose. Vampire. Mummy. Monster.
He's of
apple.
He's of
orange. Apple. Orange. Apple. Apple. Orange. Orange. Apple. Orange.
Apples and oranges seem to have all the difference. We say there's no comparing apples and oranges. You can't compare them. There's no grounds for equivalence. They're too different. Or maybe there's just no accounting for taste. Some people just like apples more than oranges, and vice versa.
Apple.
Apples on the one hand.
Orange.
Oranges on the other.
Apple.
You can't be even-handed.
Orange. Improvisation. Expand.
Oh, I'm lost. May I come in? Yes, of course. Please sit down. Okay. Who's he?
He's my brother.
Is he sick? No, he's a vampire. Wake up!
Hi.
Help!
And oranges. Apples. And oranges.
Pink.
Apples.
Blue. Yellow.
And oranges.
Red. Green. Orange.
The word orange occupies a peculiar place in our language. It is a noun designating an object that we call an orange. It is also an adjective referring to the color orange. Orange is both the name of the thing and a quality that that thing has. And in fact, the name of the color was derived from the fruit. The famous Royal House of Orange was not originally named after either the fruit or the color. The Royal House of Orange hails from the Principality of Orange in Avignon, France. In 1163, that area got its name from the name of the Roman Celtic settlement, Aricio, named for the Celtic god of water. As oranges were shipped into the south of France through this region, it became associated with the name orange. The color orange was used for the royal standard. As William I of Orange took to the Protestant side during the Huguenot Wars of the mid-16th century, the color orange became associated more and more with Protestants. When William III became King of England in 1689, orange became an important color for the Protestant minority in the mostly Catholic Ireland. William III's supporters became known as Billy's Boys, or Orangemen. The Protestants who settled in the Ulster Hills outside of Belfast were also known as Hillbillies, a term that may have followed them when they immigrated to the United States and settled in the Appalachian regions and in the Ozark Mountains.
Let me tell you a story about a man named Ted. He's a poor mountaineer, belly kept his family fed. Then one day, just shooting at some food, up through the ground came a bubbling crude. Oil, that is. Black gold.
The popular 1960s TV show, The Beverly Hillbillies, featured a family of hillbillies from the Ozarks who, after discovering oil on their land, became very rich and moved to Hollywood. It was a typical fish-out-of-water comedy showing the clash of cultures. The down-home hillbillies making their way in the sophisticated world of Hollywood stars and modern culture. Hillbilly apples set next to Hollywood oranges. A recipe for humor that lasted 9 seasons. The word orange is a bit of a fish out of water. It famously doesn't rhyme with any other word in the English language. This means that orange is a rather inert and sterile word in the playground of language. Most words can be repurposed, bent into odd associations, and forged into peculiar juxtapositions to create songs and poems, much to our childish delight. But orange has to sit this one out. It has no partners, no other words it can relate to in this regard. Rhyming involves a protocol for combining words and things together where they would normally not go. The combination of words is not based on equivalency or meaning, but on accidental features of the signs we use in our system of language. Rhyming words sound similar, but often mean quite different things. Rhyming allows us to fold language upon itself, creating a sense of meaning and connection between surprisingly different ideas and concepts. These are eccentric aspects of a particular language, meaning that words group together arbitrarily in a way that undermines the logical construction of meaning. Our fascination with this aberrant characteristic of language gives us a profusion of patterns of song and poetry, where we are able to both express literal meaning while also drawing attention to the constructed nature of language itself.
Language is a loose-fitting garment for reality. It gives us room to poetically drape the cloth of reality around us.
Purple. Black. Shirt. Pants. Skirt. Dress.
Apples and oranges are not at all like oranges and lemons then. Oranges and lemons have got another thing going on. The rhyme, the song. The words have been glued together in an informal association, not due to the logical comparison or similarity between the concepts of oranges and lemons, but because of the famous children's rhyme. Oranges and lemons. Say the bells of St. Clement's.
Oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clement's.
You owe me 5 farthings, say the bells of St. Martin's.
You owe me 5 farthings, say the bells of St. Martin's.
When will you pay me, say the bells of Old Bailey.
When will you pay me, say the bells of Old Bailey.
When I grow rich, say the bells of Shoreditch.
When I grow rich, say the bells of Shoreditch.
When will that be, say the bells of Stepney.
When will that be, say the bells of Stepney.
I do not know, says the great bell of Bow. Here comes the candle to light you to bed, and here comes the chopper to chop off your head.
And here comes the chopper to chop off your head.
This last line is likely a reference to King Henry VIII and his propensity for executing his wives. The Great Bell of Bow, referred to in the penultimate stanza there, refers to the bells of St. Mary Le Bow in the Cheapside district of the City of London. It is said that you can only be a proper Cockney if you were born within the sound of Bow bells. It was estimated that the bells could have been heard up to 6 miles to the east, 5 miles to the north, 3 miles to the south, and 4 miles to the west. Cockney is now a more general term used to designate working class people in London, and particularly those who talk with a distinctive Cockney accent.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against the sea of troubles, and by opposing, end up.
Cockney's not a language, it is only a slang, and was originated, yes, so in England. The first place it was used was over East London. It was respect for the different style pronunciation, but it wasn't really used by any and any man.
Were you born within the sounds of Bow bells in the East End of London?
No, I wasn't born close enough to hear the bells ringing from a certain church in Bow.
Ah, so that means officially you're not a Cockney.
Mockney is the portmanteau term that refers to the affected use of the Cockney accent in order to give the otherwise more upper-class person a sense of street cred. Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones was the first person to be accused of sporting a Mockney accent. Although he was born in Dartford, 14 miles from the bells of St. Mary Le Bow, and educated at the posh London School of Economics, he affected a strong Cockney accent when the Rolling Stones first started gaining prominence. Jagger's accent was possibly put on in response to the successful Beatles' Liverpudlian accents, which were actually quite authentic. A big part of the Cockney persona is the use of Cockney rhyming slang, an idiom of language common in central London. This involves using a word that at first might seem like a complete non sequitur, but is actually a two-step language game where the word spoken is one part of a common phrase or word pairing, but the other word rhymes with what you actually want to say.
Now, if I say, "Hello, me old China," am I being rude, Alice?
Oh, no, not at all. That's quite friendly. You're using Cockney rhyming slang to say, "Hello, my old mate, my old friend." So in Cockney rhyming slang, a word is replaced by another word or phrase that rhymes with it. So here, China, from a china plate, is used instead of mate. Hello, me old China.
The technical term for this type of language game is the hetmatilia, and is used to make language a bit more elusive and more exclusive for those who happen to know how it works.
And it's said that working class people in the East End of London started speaking it because they didn't want the ruling class to understand their conversations.
That's right.
An example from the early 19th century of Cockney rhyming slang would be the phrase, "Let me take a Beecham." What the person is actually saying is that they would like to take a photograph. The photograph is a still. Still rhymes with pill, and a popular pill in the Cockney time would be the Beecham's pill, a popular laxative invented by Sir Thomas Beecham. The inventor of the Beecham pill, Thomas Beecham, was also the grandfather of Sir Thomas Beecham, the famous English conductor. Sir Thomas was a well-known erudite curmudgeon who had a very low opinion of the audiences that he had to perform for. His eclectic choice of repertoire, often favoring little-known and difficult composers over more popular fare, meant that he often drew very small crowds. He once famously quipped, "The English people don't like music, but they like the sound that it makes." The Sound of Music was a film adaptation of the story of the Van Trapp family singers and their famous escape from the Anschluss in Austria before the war. The film was shot mostly on location in Salzburg, Austria. The Schloss Fromberg Palace, used for the Von Trapp family house in the film of The Sound of Music, was at the time owned by Hedy Lamarr and her then husband, Frederick Mandel. Mandel was reputedly the third richest man in Austria, having made his fortune in selling military arms and munitions. Lamarr recounts in her autobiography how Mussolini and Hitler would often attend lavish parties that he would give. Hedy Lamarr, of course, would go on to make her fame and fortune in Hollywood. She was often called the most beautiful woman in the world. She was born Hedwig Eva Maria Keisler. She had married young and began a film career in 1933, starring in a notorious German film called Ecstasy. Ecstasy was about a woman caught in a marriage with a controlling and unloving husband, which mirrored her own situation at the time. The film was controversial because it included shots of Hedy Lamarr running naked through the fields. It is even said to be the first image on celluloid simulating a female orgasm. Her husband was very displeased that his wife had appeared naked in the film. Hedy eventually left him, escaping to Paris, much like the Von Trapp family, with all her jewels. She then booked a voyage to America on the same boat as the Hollywood studio mogul Louis B. Meyer of MGM. And by the end of the trip, she had secured a contract to make her a star of the silver screen. The orgasm scene in the film is shot as a close-up. The film frames the head, cutting off the head from the body. We are meant to see the pleasure written on her face. This is the cinematic montage equivalent of Cockney rhyming slang. We are looking at the head, but we are made to think about what is happening in another part of the body that can't be shown. This is a common trope in the Hays Code era, where explicit images of sex were forbidden. Sex was indicated by a montage of associated shots, such as clothes discarded next to the bed, phallic towers, trains going into tunnels, or people smoking. Hedy Lamarr's groundbreaking headshot in Ecstasy rhymes with Andy Warhol's infamous 35-minute film, Blowjob, that frames the face of an uncredited actor in close-up while it seems as if he is receiving fellatio. Warhol is drawing attention to the construction of this kind of montage. The film alludes to the salacious content. In fact, it is said that for the filming, Warhol had found five beautiful young men to perform the sex act off camera. But the film does not show the act itself, and it is therefore quite a boring film. Peter Goodell comments that sometimes the young actor looks bored, sometimes as if he is thinking, sometimes as if he is aware of the camera, sometimes as if he is not. Critic Roy Grundman argues that Blowjob's self-reflexive devices create a new kind of spectorial address that dislodges audiences from their contemplative positions in a number of ways. Blowjob's reflexivity makes spectators intensely aware that seeing a film makes projecting onto and investing into an image a part of oneself, which is also a socialized, acculturated act. Grundman further claims that viewers oscillate between an awareness of their contingency on a larger scene and the promise of oculocentric mastery of the image. In 1968, in an attempt to expand the boundaries of their artistic world, the Monkees made a self-referential film called Head. The Monkees were, of course, one of the first manufactured boy bands. They were cast to play a Beatle-esque rock band in a TV show. They became known as the Prefab Four. But they also became a band in their own right, charting songs and touring. The postmodern film Head deliberately takes on the fiction and the reality of their characters while trying to retain the zany character of the TV show. The film failed miserably, leading to the decline of the band's popularity and alienating their fan base. But since then, the film's reputation has been rescued by a re-evaluation of the outrageous and surrealistic sequences and by the innovative music. It has become somewhat of a cult favorite. A television commercial made for the release of the film consisted of just a 30-second shot of a man looking at the camera and smiling. Near the end of the commercial, the name Head appears juxtaposed over the picture. To many, perhaps this just seemed like another monkey-esque non sequitur. but has a similar hemiotelia structure of the Cockney rhyming slang. It was decided that the ad campaign would not use the name or the images of the monkeys. The man who appears in the ad is actually the PR director of the film, John Brockman. And the idea of the headshot was to create a subtle parody of Andy Warhol's blowjob film, where the actor is being given head off screen. John Brockman was familiar with the downtown Warhol scene, and Warhol himself attended the November premiere in New York. According to Gerald Malanga, who worked for Andy Warhol in the factory, one of the five beautiful boys providing the blowjob in Warhol's film was Willard Mass. Mass was an English professor at Wagner College in Staten Island. He was married to another Warhol film star, Maria Menken. Mass and Menken had a famously stormy relationship, punctuated with alcoholic binges and robust screaming matches. Edward Albee, who was a playwright in residence at Wagner College, was said to have used their turbulent relationship as a model for his play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? The play had nothing to do with Virginia Woolf. The play actually examines the marriage of a middle-aged couple, George and Martha, as their relationship spins out of control in front of their dinner guests. In the film version of the highly successful play, the roles of George and Martha are played by Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, who are at that point married to each other in another famously topsy-turvy relationship. When they would stay in a hotel, they would have to rent the rooms above and below them because the noise of their screaming arguments would disturb the guests. It was said that in much of their award-winning performances, they didn't really have to act that much at all.
Saw a face from my childhood days. A smiling girl, not a friend. Milky red, funny face, smiling smiles. Mother and son.
As Hedy Lamarr's star rose in Hollywood, she landed a string of impressive film roles, where she was constantly celebrated for her great beauty. But she grew restless in her gilded Hollywood cage and turned her attention to more heady matters. She had always been interested in inventing, and with a background of weapon design that she acquired from living with her first husband, Hedy Lamarr set about trying to create a jam-proof radio guidance system for torpedoes. With the help of the composer George Antill, she designed a frequency-hopping, spread-spectrum radio communications system based on how piano rolls worked in player pianos. In 1942, they were granted patent number 2,292,387 for a secret communication system. They gave their invention to the Navy, who didn't develop and use it until the 1960s. Their frequency hopping system would later be used in communications protocols, using shortwave UHF radio waves in communications between phones and computers. We now know these as Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. Bluetooth was proposed in 1997 by Jim Kardash, who developed the standard for communications between computers and cell phones. The name is from the 10th century Danish king Harald Bluetooth, who unified the Danish tribes into a single kingdom. Kardash hoped that Bluetooth would unify the competing protocols into one universal standard. The distinctive logo for Bluetooth incorporates and merges two separate Danish runes, the H and the B, standing for Harald Bluetooth. The entanglement of two letters is known to typographers as a ligature. It involves the combining of two or more letter forms into a single graphic. A common example would be the ampersand, or what we often see as the and symbol. This is derived from the combination of the letters E and T, which spell the Latin word et, or and. Letters can become entangled through ligature, or they can be entangled through a set of associations and meanings. For instance, when I say the letters H and B, you will probably think about pencils. H, which means hard, and B, meaning black, were introduced into the grading of pencils in the early 20th century by the English pencil-making company Brockman. The HB grade is the most popular kind of pencil in the world. But in 1958, the pencil became a kind of ligature when Hyman Lippmann of Philadelphia attached an eraser to the end of the pencil for convenient use in erasing mistakes. This turned the object into a tool that could both produce meaning and take meaning away. The pencil, as opposed to the pen, then became the instrument of writing through entangled thoughts that could be easily written and easily removed. Industrial landscape of Philadelphia, where Hyman Lippmann invented the eraser, provided the inspiration for David Lynch's classic underground film, Eraserhead. Having grown up in an impoverished and crime-ridden area of Philadelphia, Lynch translated this landscape into a dystopian, dreamlike world for his film. The startling image at the end of the film shows a young boy finding a man's severed head in the street that he picks up and takes to a pencil factory where it is turned into erasers. This image, Lynch says, came to him in a dream and was the beginning point for the entire film.
Please sit down. Okay. Who's he?
He's my brother.
Is he sick? No, he's a vampire.
Sick? Dead?
Is he...
Vampire, mummy, monster. Improvisation. Expand.
Oh, I'm lost.
May I come in?
Yes, of course. Please sit down.
Okay. Who's he?
He's my brother.
Is he sick?
No, he's a vampire.
Wake up!
In the digital world, words and marks can easily be erased from the screen. The computer screen has become a surface that is constantly being drawn on and erased and drawn on and erased again, over and over. In 1997, the woman depicted on the boxes of the CorelDRAW software was Hedy Lamarr. The picture, drawn with CorelDRAW software, had won CorelDRAW's yearly cover design contest in 1996, the artist copying a famous picture of Hedy Lamarr. Lamarr sued Corel for using the image without her permission, but in court, Corel argued that she did not own the rights to this image. The parties reached an undisclosed settlement in 1998, and since then, Hedy's face has become identified with the software company. But as Hedy's beautiful face was adorning the packaging of the new digital pencil, old age was taking its effect on the star. She went through a series of blotched plastic surgeries that she hoped would preserve her good looks. As a result, she increasingly refused to be seen in public and ended up becoming a recluse. In 1966, Andy Warhol made a parody of Lamarr's fading celebrity in a film called Hedy. The role of Hedy Lamarr was played by a drag queen who visits a plastic surgeon demanding to be transformed into the 14-year-old girl she believes herself to be. She is then caught shoplifting and put on trial, with her five ex-husbands making up the jury. The Hedy character remains self-centered and detached throughout the trial, posing and primping and bursting out in renditions of I Feel Pretty and Young at Heart. At the moment that this film was made, she had just released her autobiography and even entertained ambitions of returning to the silver screen in a film called Picture Mommy Dead. But after accusations of shoplifting, the role was given to Zsa Gabor. In 1991, although she had thousands of dollars of uncashed checks in her purse, Hedy Lamarr was arrested on charges of shoplifting in Florida for stealing $21.48 worth of laxatives.
Smiling girl, not afraid. funny face, smiling smiles.
Mother, and son
stood by a dead.
You have been listening to Nothing to See Here, experimental radio from NASCAD University. This episode was called Geechum's Pill, Notes on Entanglement. This episode was written and performed by David Clark. Sound design was by David Clark. For more information, please check out our Facebook page, Nothing to See Here Radio, and for more episodes, search for Nothing to See Here Radio on SoundCloud.com.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.